Live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Got my mojo working, but just don't work on you.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to learn about how certain genes in a healthy environment can lengthen your lifespan from the University of Buffalo. And I'm going to spend a little extra time on this gene question because I think it really is important. The more we find out about how our environment impacts our genes, the healthier we're going to be. And then, could a combined dietary supplement ward off heart disease? That could save 600,000 deaths from heart attacks and stroke each year. Cardiff University in the UK will explain that. Fructose. It's in so many things that we drink and eat. UCLA says it alters hundreds of brain genes, which can lead to a wide range of diseases. Also today, the Mediterranean diet, once again, is linked to a lower risk of heart attacks and less strokes. And that's University of Auckland in Australia. They do a lot of good work down there. And sleep loss, not good. It's detrimental to the blood vessels. University of Oulun and Finland. Also today, I don't have a guest because I want to spend more time on some thought-provoking commentaries. All of my commentaries, whether I write them, which I generally stay up at night when it's quiet, when I'm on the road, which I am now, and write them, or whether I'm reporting on someone else's commentaries, like Chris Hedges, they're meant to get us to think a little differently on topics we may not have realized how important they are. Today, from Professor Henry Giroux, Beyond the Politics of the Big Lie, the Education Deficit and the New Authoritarianism. Also, I just want to raise one issue today about how the prison state destroys families. 1 in 8 poor children have a parent behind bars. Think that doesn't matter? Wait till you hear the number involved. And also, isn't it time that we didn't ask any longer our politicians? We demanded that they stop this disastrous drug war. I'll give you some perspective on that. So I think you'll find these interesting. So you see, we have a lot to talk about in a lot of different areas. Let's begin with our genes. Our genes are so important. Recently, I asked someone who was fretting and negative and complaining and whining and making themselves to be a victim of everything. I said, what has the tree done to assault you? Nothing. What do you mean? Well, has that beautiful weeping willow tree on that water there, has it done anything to offend you, to threaten you, to terrify you, to demean you, to deny you, to avoid you? No. Why don't you go sit beside it? Trees talk. Trees communicate vibrationally. That's a scientific fact. And why don't you see what you can hear in the vibration, pick up and feel? Because you've got thousands of trees around you, and they're all there to share something positive. Or you can stay in the clutter of the 56,000 different conversations we have in our mind each day, every 24 hours, and 95% of them are going to be negative, where at some point in your life you will feel that you have and possibly have been abused or in some way made a victim, and you keep bringing that into each day. So in the real world that we're living in today, you can't be in two places simultaneously. Whatever you're principally connected to with your mind is the dominant energy. Now, we have a basic rule of physics. No two energies can share the same space with equal intensity at the same time. So if you're principally negative, that's your dominant energy. And you will then defend that right to feel negative or depressed or anxious or fearful by surrounding yourself with hundreds of thousands of impulses from the subconscious locked in your DNA that justify that. Or you can make the dominant energy mindful meditative. Mindful meditation means intent. What is your intent in this moment? Is it to connect with nature? Is it to connect with healing? Is it to connect with that juice of you're drinking, that fruit you're eating? Are you connecting with that puppy or kitten that are playing? Because if you are, that's your dominant energy. And that's a good energy. And it's from that good energy that our body heals. Nutrition at its best, absolute supreme best, on a scale of 1 to 100 is 20. That's the level I consume it at. All right? Most people, even in the health movement, are lucky to be above 10. So if you think you're going to eat your way to good health, you're mistaken. Really mistaken. That is the monotheistic approach to life. I'll take this piece as something good, but I'll bring it into a whole lot of pieces that are not, and somehow that good will illuminate and make everything else bad disappear. It doesn't work. It's like smoking a cigarette and taking a vitamin C tablet. You're still going to get cancer. So if you have good exercise, really good, 6 days a week, aerobic, and including a lot of intense aerobic, and then you have 4 days a week of resistance, add another 15% onto that. Now, that's at its best, but most people don't exercise that way. Either they overwork out, which depletes their immune system and strains their body, or they under. So now at our best, we're 35%. Now take in stress management, where you really deal appropriately with all stressors in life. You don't overreact, and you don't try to avoid it by hiding or sublimating. What you don't want to contend with or feel that you're helpless in contending with. But if you do it right, really right, you're at about 20%. So how you deal with stress is as important as what you eat. At its best, that means you really are in control of how you're going to respond to negative situations or crisis. So if you were at your best with exercise, with diet, and with stress, you're at about best 55%. Throw in supplements, the best supplements you can, and you're at about another 10%. You're at 65%. What's the rest? The single greatest healing possible comes from nature and through the value of our beliefs. The value of our beliefs will include our faith, our relationships with our family and friends and loved ones, partners, how we transcend the limitations of our boundaries that limited us into a higher state of awareness, a greater being of creativity. That's your 35%. So with most people, they want to start with what's easy. Give me something that's bad in my diet I can change. What about all the other stuff? I don't want to change it. I can't change it. Well, then you're stuck in a duality. One foot's on one side of a canyon, the other's on the other side, and you're not committing to either side. So you're never going to heal. You're just going to be extraordinarily frustrated, and all the while your immune system is going to take a hit because of stress. So I always start people dealing with each one of these in a gradual way, but I put a lot of emphasis upon the 35% because you can see the greatest improvement. And by the way, after 1.5 hours of sitting under a weeping willow tree, a person said, "Wow, I walk by that tree all the time. I never even noticed it. And just sitting there under the tree, not allowing myself to think negative thoughts, looking at the water, listening to the birds, it was transformative. It was magical." Well, guess what? The person's blood sugar came down. Their blood pressure came down. They were able to sleep that evening. That is what's possible. And we have nature all around us. That brings me to the University of Buffalo. Researchers at the University of Buffalo Research Institute on Addictions have discovered how a gene in the brain's dopamine system can play an important role in prolonging lifespan. And it must be, however, coupled with, listen carefully, quote, a healthy environment that includes exercise. So, what it means is that if you get yourself into a healthy environment, one where you feel at ease, at peace, and there it's almost always nature, and you exercise, then you've got two good things going for you. So add in 15 and 35, and you're at 50% right there, right off the bat. Now, I won't go into it today, but I traveled around the world over a five-year period studying the longest-lived people in the world, and I concluded that it wasn't their diet. In the end, their greatest single longevity factor was the quality of their value, their beliefs, and the fact they were vigorous. They also ate closer to the land, more natural, wholesome, clean foods. So keep that in mind. It can make a difference. You can extend your lifespan by being around nature and even having a garden. Even growing inside, you can grow a lemon tree, you can grow an avocado tree, you can grow a loquat tree. Yeah, all inside. And you can trim it, even if you live in Alaska, and you can keep grow lights on it with full spectrum and stop it at 6 feet, and then clip the top, and it grows full and abundant. From Cardiff University in the United Kingdom, by combining marine fish oil and cacao extract, that's your chocolate, and phytoestrogens into a dietary take-in every day, they were able to fight against heart disease. That's a new study. And scientists in South Wales and Cardiff University found that those ingredients helped clean the arteries, what is called furring, F-U-R-I-N-G, and using a series of cell-based experimental models, they published this in PLOS ONE, the scientific journal. So three things. So why don't we look at three things that we could do? You've got your essential fatty acids, but mind you, I'm convinced they could have found the same results if they used walnut oil, avocado oil, or flaxseed oil, which are also high in DHA and the omega-3 fatty acids. They didn't test that, but when they did test the fish oil, it worked. But it's the fraction of the fish oil that makes a difference, and that same identical fraction is in vegan sources too. And the flavanols are what you get in chocolate, and the phytosterols, you get that in tempeh, tofu, easy to get that in quality, non-genetically engineered soy. So we can make a big difference. And what is the outcome? And this is important. Go back to the beginning. You can ward off heart disease. 600,000 Americans died last year because of heart disease. We can save some lives. From UCLA, syrup contains fructose. Fructose can alter brain genes linked to many diseases. That's what they're saying. Quote, a range of diseases, from diabetes to cardiovascular disease, from Alzheimer's disease to attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, are linked to changes to genes in the brain. And that means fructose is bad for the brain and contributes to all those diseases because it destroys brain cells. So that's soda. Even if you just had one soda a week, it's still killing brain cells. So give up the fructose, save your brain. And from University of Auckland in New Zealand, the Mediterranean diet is linked to a lower risk of heart attacks and strokes. Quote, the Mediterranean diet high in fruit, vegetables, fish, unrefined foods is linked to a lower risk of heart attack and stroke. And that's according to 15,000 people in 39 countries around the world. And this was published in European Heart Journal. So, the Mediterranean diet, which is rich in olive oil and wild plants, lots of herbs, fresh, they really emphasize fresh. Interesting, because when I was in Italy and Spain and France, it was very common to end a meal with fruit. When I was in England and Scotland and Ireland, it was a dessert. and what a difference in the health outcome. Those are three of the sickest countries as far as health of their population versus three of the countries that are the healthiest. So always use that. And finally, sleep loss, which is epidemic, is detrimental to blood vessels. This is from the University in Finland. Quote, lack of sleep has previously been found to impact the activation of the immune system, inflammation, and carbohydrate metabolism in the hormones that regulate appetite. Now, University of Helsinki researchers have found that sleep loss also influences cholesterol metabolism. That's not good, because if you're not metabolizing cholesterol, you could have elevated cholesterol, including the low-density lipoprotein, and that puts you at risk of a heart attack or stroke. So get your sleep so that you're less likely to have cardiovascular risk. I'm Gary Noll. That's the latest on health and healing. Back in a moment, we have a whole lot more to share with you. All over the United States on stations and our good friends up in Woodstock. Every day they're playing this program. Thank you. Love to come up there. I'll be coming up there this summer to premiere my new feature film. Well, one of them. And I've got four. Over the next 14 months, I'll be bringing one out. And the first big one, the hard-hitting one, will be this summer. Always look forward to going to Woodstock and Rosendale. Used to have a farm up there 15 years. Many people in this audience used to visit it in the summertime and learn about sustainable living and organic farming, the old Fertiller Farm. I always drive by there on my way just to see its evolution, what's happened to it since I turned it over to the people who took it from there. In any case, we have a lot to share. And the other day, on Earth Day, I had from India, from her organic farm up near the base of the Himalayas, Vandana Shiva, one of the great spiritual feminists and ecologist in the world. And if you didn't have a chance to hear it on Earth Day, go to the archives at progressiveradionetwork.com and listen to our Earth Day program. I think you'll appreciate it. Also, a lot of people, when they tune in, they're not always in front of a land-based station. Sometimes they are out driving around, traveling throughout the United States or Canada, and they think, oh, I can't listen to you now. Oh, yes, you can. A whole lot of people listen over the telephone, and so you can as well. And in a moment, so you can get a pencil and paper, I'll give you that number, and that way you can write it down, snubber, where you're at noon, Monday to Friday, 5 days a week, and Tuesday night for the Progressive Commentary Hour. We have a powerful one tomorrow. You can always listen over the phone if you can't listen on a terrestrial station. Now, that number, write it down, 712-775-6850. 712-775-6850. Well, I was told Friday we just passed 20 million on the telephone minutes listening. 20 million. That's a whole bunch of people listening over the telephone. I believe that we should completely abolish the entire criminal justice system that we have in the United States. We should base the punishment upon the nature of the offense and whether or not we are capable of helping that person be rehabilitated to reenter society so they do not commit the crimes again. Understand the nature of what they did, why they did it, and hopefully learn a lesson so they're not victimizing themselves, their families, or anyone else. But to send people to prison for using drugs is, in my opinion, completely wrong on every level. Because if you're going to send someone to prison because you think or you believe that the drug they're taking is a danger to themselves or society, then far more people die every year from alcohol than go back to prohibition. How'd that work for you? Well, you got organized crime from it, La Cosa Nostra. You got Frank Costello. You got Lucky Luciano, who ran the mob, and Meyer Lansky. And that didn't turn out so well, did it? Well, look what we have today. Over 150,000 disappeared and murdered in Mexico alone. There's no place now safe in Central and South America because of the enormous influence of organized crime, the narco-terrorists down there. Take away the profit incentive, and you no longer are going to have that. In its place, instead of looking at this as a danger to society, look at it as people needing help. Because after all, do you actually think most people do drugs, methamphetamine, heroin, cocaine, whatever it is, because they want to hurt themselves? There are easier ways and quicker ways to hurt yourself than that. They're escaping. So why don't we have a more humanistic and spiritual approach to have drug counseling centers using holistic therapeutic models, not pharmaceutical models, in every community in the United States? And do you know where you have more people abusing drugs? It's not the ghettos. It's not people of color. Not by any measure. They're disproportionately caught and sentenced to longer terms. It's white, affluent, and middle-class people and upper-middle-class people throughout the United States. So we need to help people, not put them in prison. That's just profitable. Only 10 years ago, 60,000 children in the United States had a parent in prison. That's 10 years ago. Today, 2.7 million children have a parent in prison. That's an awful lot of children. And the child has committed no crime. The child is not a threat to society. The child should be nurtured and loved and guided and supported against all the odds against them. Instead, there is no consideration at all at the state, local, or federal level for the child. What do you think happens when a child's parent goes to prison? They're going to suffer from a lot of personal problems throughout their entire life. Low self-esteem, problems in school. They have a lot of negative outcomes. They have a lot of health problems. The average child doesn't. And a lot of behavioral problems. They have a hard time with grade retention. There is a stigma and a shame associated with a parent in school, whether stated or unstated, and I believe that this entire war on drugs was stupid from the get-go, and it does not reduce crime, by the way, at all. And in fact, every study shows that creating more prisoners does not reduce crime one bit. So why not let all those prisoners out, expunge their records, help them with rehabilitation? That would put an awful lot of people to work who otherwise are minimally or not working at all in the professions of helping people. That would be a more constructive thing. And think of all the money we would save. We could then take that $30 billion a year and put it into proper schooling, helping the schools in the areas where children are going and giving them the counseling so they actually have a chance at life. That's not likely to happen, even though I wished it were, because there's too many people invested in the outcome, too many people profiting from it. And they control the media, they control the judicial, they control the legislative, they control the executive, they control the Supreme Court, they control every single step in the way of making a change or transition. They control it, and they're not going to give it up. The American public is suffering from an education deficit. What's this mean? According to Professor Henry Giroux, it means that exhibiting a growing inability to think critically, to question authority, to be reflective, to weigh evidence, to discriminate between reasoned arguments and opinions, listen across differences. Don't scream at someone. Don't yell up. Don't get in their face. You don't learn from that. You don't learn the strength of your own argument, nor the weakness of your argument, nor the strength or weakness of someone else's argument. So learn to listen and then engage the mutually informing relationship between private problems and broader public issues. Because right now we have growing a political culture of illiteracy. It's not merely a problem of the individual, one that points to simple ignorance. It is a collective and social problem that goes to the heart of the increasing attack on democratic public spheres and supportive public institutions that promote analytical capacities and thoughtful exchange and a willingness to view knowledge as a resource for informed modes of individual and social agency. And one of the major consequences of the current education deficit and the pervasive culture of illiteracy that sustains it is what I call the ideology of the big lie, which propagates the myth that the free market system is the only mechanism to ensure human freedom and safeguard democracy. Nothing could be further from the truth. In fact, it's just the opposite. The education deficit, along with declining levels of civic literacy, is also part of the American public's collective refusal to know. You've heard me mention many times on this program, there's a difference between ignorance of a subject and intentional not wanting to know anything about that subject. A focused resistance on the part of many members of a society to deal with knowledge that challenges common sense, or to think reflectively about facts and truths that are unsettling in terms of how they disturb some of our most cherished beliefs, especially those that denounce the sins of big government and legitimize existing levels of economic insecurity and social inequality, and reduced or minimal government intervention in the field of welfare legislation. The decline of civility and civic literacy in American society is a political dilemma, and the social production of which is traceable to a broader constellation of forces deeply rooted in the shifting nature of education and the varied cultural apparatuses that produce it. It's extending from the new digital technologies and online journals to the mainstream media of newspapers and magazines and television. Politics is now held hostage to what the late Raymond Williams called the force of permanent education, a kind of public power spread through a plethora of teaching machines that are shaping how our most powerful ideas are formed. And what is valuably stressed is the educational force of our whole social and cultural experience. It is therefore concerned not only with continuing education of a formal and informal kind, but with what the whole environment, its institutions, relationships actively and profoundly teaches. Permanent education also refers to the field in which our ideas of the world, ourselves, and our possibilities are most widely and often most powerfully formed and disseminated. To work for the recovery of control in this field is then under any pressures a priority. For who can doubt looking at television and any newspaper or reading the women's magazines that here centrally is teaching and the teaching financed and distributed in a much larger way than is your formal education? We have to understand that the insight about the relationship between education and politics is more important today than it was in the 1960s when many of us were developing our ideas and committing to some social issues. The educational forces of the wider culture are now one of the primary, if not most powerful, detriments of what counts as knowledge and agency in politics and democracy itself. The machinery of permanent education and the public power relationships these create have become the main framing mechanisms in determining what information gets included, who speaks, what stories are told, what representations translate into reality, and what is considered normal or subversive. Virtually everything that is true today in the alternative movement, meditation works, exercise is important. The older you get, the more you should exercise. The older you get, the more attention you should pay to your diet. That nutrients make a difference, that you must live closer to your environment. Green space is important. You must raise a child with responsibility the child has to others in their environment. You must have some disciplines, both moral disciplines, which are spiritually inclined, and also physical disciplines, so the child doesn't end up obese. But the child's going to end up obese if you don't have your disciplines yourself. If you are intentionally negligent on yourself, then how are you going to be less negligent on your children? These are self-evident truths, and everything that the alternative movement has been espousing for the last 45 to 50 years has been shown to be true. We are intimately involved with our environment. We were against pesticides. They were not. We were for exercise. They were not. We were for non-invasive therapies. They were not. We were for the empowerment of women and women over their own bodies. They were not. They gave them synthetic hormone replacement therapy. They gave them unnecessary mammography. They gave them unnecessary radical mastectomies. They gave them unnecessary Valium and lithium and Quaaludes and uppers and downers. That today, 25% of all women between 25 and 45 are on their drugs. They are wrong. We were right. We were right about not going into Vietnam. It would not be a domino effect. It would not influence our authority. To the contrary, had we worked with Ho Chi Minh, he wanted to form his united Vietnamese constitution based upon our constitution. And he asked for help. Instead of helping him, we bombed him. We created false flags. We had a false flag in the Gulf of Tonkin Bay. So Lyndon Johnson, one of the most demonic, evil human beings to ever step foot into the presidency, would then cause 50,000 Americans to lose their lives, but up to 2.5 million Vietnamese. And the legacy of death continues with all those anti-personnel mines that are still going on and Agent Orange. We were right when we said that the vaccines that these soldiers were getting, including anthrax and botulism, were toxic. And we ended up with a whole generation of otherwise healthy people coming back with Gulf War syndrome that they then denied existed for 25 years. We were right that electromagnetic pulses out of cell phones and computers were adversely affecting the brain and chromosomes. They were wrong. We were right about cleaning up your home and work environment because it impacted your health. They were wrong. We were right about the importance of fiber. They were wrong. They wanted a meat-based diet with no fiber. We wanted a plant-based diet. All of the science is on our side. There are over 1,000 studies showing you the different ways of implementing the Mediterranean or the Greek or the Okinawan plant-based diet will extend your life and help you prevent disease. The Harvard's nurses study, the Harvard's doctor study, over 40 years have concurred with this. And yet, we're eating more meat than ever before, less vegetables than ever before, and we're unhealthy in the extreme. We're the most unhealthy group of people on the planet per population. We have the most obesity in our children, most diabetes in our children. We don't do a goddamn thing right. We do everything wrong. And yet, because we are not the official sources, the dominant energy, the dominant storytellers, the dominant purveyors of information, we are considered relegated to the sidelines. And those who are corrupt in the extreme, those at the New York Times, those at the Washington Post, those that engage with zealous self-righteousness and censorship and then ask for your money to promote free speech, that doesn't work well. They'll see that coming up. They are in power. Those who challenge it are excluded. So every time you hear someone telling the truth, watch how quickly that person is attacked and how quickly what they share is dismissed. And 10 to 20 years later, someone says, you know, they were right. Well, it's no longer about the person being right. It's about when will people stop being so stupid. It is not the Lyndon Johnson that we should fear, the Hillary or Bill Clinton. They're sociopaths. Those are so self-evident. You would have to be completely in a coma with an ice pick through your brain not to see that. Anyone who listens to Rush Limbaugh or these other self-righteous, you know, very highly imbalanced emotional people, that's my personal opinion, they're not the problem. The problem's not the National Security Agency. The problem's not the military-industrial complex. And the problem's not spying on everyone, wanting to know every single thing about you. The problem is not asset forfeiture of $4 billion from innocent people who did nothing wrong, were not convicted of anything. They just stole their money, stole their cars, stole their homes, stole their businesses. That's not the problem. The problem's not all the pesticides and genetic engineering, all the sugar and the fat being stuffed down your throat. That's not the problem. The problem's not all these megalomaniacs on the air pontificating as if they know what they're talking about when they're conjugating verbs. That's not the problem. The problem is not the militarization of our police and the police seeking out those of what they consider a danger to society, the colored people of the world, and harassing them and jailing them. It's not the bad laws that end up favoring one, the treaties like NAFTA and GATT. That's not the problem. Those are all symptoms of the problem. They're all extensions of the problem. The problem is the American public refusing to be fully informed. That's the problem. Because a fully informed person, you're not going to give a vaccine to. You're not going to have them take a Quaalude. You're not going to be able to get them to shoot any form of toxic chemotherapy into their body. 5-fluorouracil. Not going to happen. Because they're going to read the literature and know that there is no science supporting chemotherapy to extend the quality of your life or length of life. You can't get them to buy food watching it on television by some actor making it seem like drinking a particular beer or eating a particular, you know, fast food is going to be really good for you. They're too smart for that. We were not born with the capacity to make bad choices. We were born with the capacity to make good choices. The bad choices came from our conditioning. So for the first time in modern history, centralized commercial institutions that extend from the traditional broadcast culture to all those new interactive screens, rather than parents and churches and schools, tell most of the stories that shape the lives of the American public. Now, this is no small matter, since the stories that society tells about itself, the ideals of democracy and its future, yeah, that's what's important. Most of the stories now told to the American public are about the necessity of neoliberal capitalism, permanent war, the virtues of never-ending culture of fear, overconsumption, making debt seem like an asset, buying things you don't need with money you don't have, and then having disease from the stress from seeing the bills, going to prisons, including debtors' prisons, not being able to get out. And those who profit from debtors' prisons, the poorest among us, are those who are easiest exploited. That's what people are dealing with. The domestic front reveals in that we have a culture that welcomes the death of the social state. The necessary all-embracing reach of the market to determine every aspect of our lives. The reduction of freedom to the freedom to consume. The pathology of social relations. Not under the rule of commodities and finance capital, and the notion that everyone is ultimately responsible for their own fate in a world that now resembles a shark tank. So you're in a shark tank, and all you got are smiling sharks waiting for you to have a nosebleed. Democracies need informed citizens to make them work. And they can only survive amid a formative culture that produces individuals willing to think critically, imagine otherwise, and act responsibly. Americans seem to have moved away from that possibility, that willingness to think through and beyond the systemic production of the given, the pull of conformity, the comforting assurance of certainty, and the painless retreat into the world of common sense. We are more than mere stupidity. There was a mode of manufactured thoughtlessness that pointed both to the disappearance of politics and constituted one of the most serious threats facing democracy. That threat is no longer merely a despairing element of philosophical reflection. It has become the new reality of American life. The political, economic, and social coordinates of authoritarianism are all around us, and through the educational force of the broader culture, they are becoming more normalized and more dangerous. There is little difference between what I'm calling the education deficit and the reigning market authoritarianism, with its claim to be both synonymous with democracy and unquestionable in its assumptions and policies. The education deficit, a hallmark achievement of neoliberal capitalism, has produced a version of authoritarianism with a soft edge. The person that promises you everything that you feel is important, and indeed is, and delivers you just the opposite. At what point do you start judging a person by what they do and not by what they say? If Bernie Sanders is truly wanting to head a revolution, then he would do the only smart thing he could do instead of betraying his entire population. Until Bernie Sanders renounces Hillary Clinton's support and creates a third party. Right now, here's the math. For those who are willing to listen, the Democrats have about 27% of registered voters, the Republicans about 22 to 23%, but the independents have 42%. That means that right now, the independents will determine the next president if there was a real independent to run. Jill Stein is the only qualified independent, but she is not allowed in, and as a result, she will not be part of it. If Bernie Sanders split off and became an independent, he would win the presidency because he would have the majority of independents and progressives supporting him. If he's nothing other than having his moment, his Bernie moment, but at the end, handing it all over to Hillary Clinton, which is what many people fear, then he will betray the entire movement and all those young idealists, and they will not vote for Hillary Clinton. No true progressive would ever demean themselves to vote for a Clinton or a Bush or an Obama. After all, they do their homework. They are educated. And as a result, then it will be a battle that Donald Trump in all probability would win. Keep that in mind. And so what we need is we need to stop thinking that the free market and all of its different commodities and all of its fundamentalism is what's going to save us. It will not. Constant, perpetual growth, we'd need 2.5 planets to keep that growth going. You want to bring jobs back? Nothing I see with anyone is promising would bring a single job back to America. Reindustrialize America from the heartland and the rust belts, from the Appalachians out into the Midwest, down into Texas, by bringing back interest-free loans to small entrepreneurs, where with each person they hire at $1 million of loan, they have to give a living wage and health benefits. And that would bring 10 to 15 million people back in, plus businesses, and cause dollars to circulate in local economies, which would rejuvenate the American economy. Doable? You bet. We gave $21 trillion to jumpstart through quantitative easing and other loans, interest-free loans to big banks, and they didn't hire another person. They didn't open a business. It was purely self-interest. The only profit any bank has made has been from the money it's gotten from the American public, not because it's smart enough to run a business. I'd love to see the head of Goldman Sachs run any small business. They can't. They're failures at everything except how to manipulate and create perceptions of reality that don't exist in reality. So in conclusion, we have to simply take back the power to make the decisions for ourselves and stop allowing the corruption within the governmental system. It is all corrupt. And the corruption within the free market system, it is all corrupt. And allow common sense, reason, and our own education within every area of our life to determine the choices we should make, and then work collectively at the local level until we have enough power to speak at the regional level and finally at the national level for change. We're doing that now with vaccines. Watch Vaccine Nation. Watch Autism Made in the USA. Most importantly, watch the newest one. Watch The Silent Epidemic. Real scientists, toxicologists, immunologists saying there's no proof there's safety and efficacy in these vaccines. Because if you're going to do something, watch the truth. And I'm going to call out Andrew Wakefield on my program. Buddy, we're all supported you. Why are you still pro-vaccine when there's so much literature and proof to the contrary? It's time that we took a stand and not a equivocating political stand, one for real change, not adaptation. Adaptation is always going to work against us. Transformation works for us. The current system of politics, the current system of commerce, the current system of social institutions work against us. Joining them, you're only enabling them and compromising your own power to come up with reasoned and more insightful conclusions. I'm Gary Noll. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day.